As the hospitality industry continues to struggle, there's one category seemingly without hope, the New Orleans neighborhood bar.
I don't have the energy right now to go and try and fight for this, you know, because at every step, it just seems that we are on the bad end of things and not being considered at all.
Coming up next on Louisiana Eats, we look at the plight of these community hubs as owners attempt to safely reopen amid rapidly changing regulation.
And the worst thing they did to us was let us open back up and then shut us back down, because now people think we're still open. A lot of people don't know little neighborhood bars that they're closing up slowly but surely.
Is it last call for neighborhood bars? Owners and advocates weigh in on this week's Louisiana Eats. That's coming up next. But first, the news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Anger is building outside a courthouse in Louisville, Kentucky, where moments ago a judge announced lesser charges of wanton endangerment in the first degree against one of three officers who were involved in the deadly shooting of Breonna Taylor. Taylor, an African-American EMT, was shot several times after officers working a narcotics investigation burst into her home late one night last March. Taylor's family fought for manslaughter charges that carry stronger prison sentences than wanton endangerment. Jefferson County Judge Annie O'Connell has granted Brett Hankinson, bond.
I will grant the motion and assign bond in the amount of $15,000 full cash and issue a warrant.
State Attorney General Daniel Cameron said a short time ago that Taylor's death was a tragedy. He also defended the decision to charge one officer based on the investigation into the actions of all three officers. The FBI and the Department of Homeland Security are warning that foreign actors and cybercriminals will try to undermine the election by questioning the legitimacy of the final count. Warning coming as a Trump campaign video warns without evidence that the president's opponents will use millions of fraudulent ballots to overturn results. Here's NPR's Pam Fessler.
The government warning is stark. It says bad actors could exploit the time between Election Day and when the vote count is officially certified to convince the public that the results are illegitimate. Many states expect to be counting ballots for several days due to a large number of mail-in votes. But President Trump has said repeatedly that he wants the results on Election Day. And in an effort to recruit Republican poll watchers, Donald Trump Jr. said in a video Tuesday that the, quote, radical left is planning to steal the election by adding millions of fraudulent ballots. He provided no evidence, and most election officials say such a scheme would be impossible. Pam Fessler, NPR News.
The administration's dialing up its attack on social media companies it accuses of bias against conservatives. Attorney General Bill Barr is asking Congress to amend Section 203 of the Communications and Decency Act to hold social media companies liable for their content. A fourth COVID-19 vaccine candidate starts wide-scale testing in the United States this week. We have an update from NPR's Joe Palca.
The vaccine is made by Janssen Pharmaceuticals, a part of Johnson & Johnson. It's based on technology the company used to create a successful vaccine for Ebola. The plan is to enroll up to 60,000 volunteers in the study. One group will receive the vaccine, the other an inert placebo. The primary goal is to find out if the vaccine candidate can prevent moderate to severe cases of COVID-19. The Janssen vaccine has a potential advantage over other candidates in that it may only require a single dose to be effective. It's also easier to distribute to vaccination centers because it doesn't require special refrigeration.
Joe Palca reporting. This is NPR. Alexander Lukashenko has been sworn in for a sixth term as the president of Belarus. NPR's Lucian Kim says the ceremony was held in secret.
The previously unannounced ceremony was held in the capital, Minsk, with several hundred regime officials in attendance. Alexander Lukashenko took the oath of office, swearing to serve the Belarusian people. He had claimed a landslide in August presidential election, sparking mass protests and a violent police crackdown on demonstrators. Lukashenko's main opponent, Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, called the ceremony a farce and said she was the only leader chosen by the Belarusian people. The European Union does not recognize Lukashenko as Belarus's legitimate president. German Chancellor Angela Merkel's spokesman said the inauguration ceremony does not make him any more legitimate. Lucian Kim, NPR News, Moscow.
The European Union's new strategy for managing asylum seekers and economic migrants is just the latest attempt to increase support for those hardest hit by the influx. Terry Schultz reports the new plan changes past approaches that failed in forcing countries to take in people from crowded camps in Greece and Italy.
The European Commission acknowledges its previous attempts haven't worked. After the huge surge of people in 2015, all EU governments were assigned a proportionate number of asylum seekers they were supposed to resettle, but many still didn't accept any. This new proposal would allow countries to either take in people who've been given refugee status or to help deport those with failed applications.
Terry Schultz reporting. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Uma, a cloud-based phone service for small businesses with an automated virtual receptionist and mobility features to run their businesses from anywhere. More at OOMA.com.
Listener support allows KRVS to provide exceptional programs in unprecedented times. You can help make sure that we can continue to grow to meet the ever-changing needs of our community. Contribute to your local source for news and information, music and culture at krvs.org.
Louisiana Eats is brought to you with support from Louisiana Fish Fry, a staple of Louisiana kitchens for nearly 40 years. Maker of batters, coatings, boils, tartar sauce, cocktail sauce, and more. Dig into homemade Louisiana flavor. From our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. The COVID-19 pandemic has wreaked havoc on businesses of all stripes, none more than the hospitality industry. In that struggling sector, there's one category seemingly without hope, the New Orleans Neighborhood Bar. These watering holes, where for generations people have gathered to celebrate and mourn, are about to become a thing of the past. Since the initial shutdown in March, most Orleans Parish bars were only allowed to operate for a brief and very confusing time between June 13th and midnight on July 12th. Trying to comply with the ever-changing regulations, some have pivoted to conditional restaurant licenses, but many others don't have the kitchen space or ability to serve food. These bar owners are left in a cruel sort of limbo, while all across the state, to-go drinks are being allowed and even encouraged by state government. Here in the home of the Go Cup, to-go drinks are banned. We're tackling this topic in hopes that listeners everywhere will understand the true plight of New Orleans neighborhood bars, places essential to the very fabric of this city's culture. We'll begin with retired New Orleans firefighter Kevin Lee and learn why every day he sits alone inside of his Irish Channel bar, Pete's out in the cold. And then, Kelder Summers Jones of Bayou Road's Whiskey and Sticks explains her predicament and why she bought that frozen drink machine. Polly Watts, one of the leading voices in this fight, reveals why recent calls with City Hall have left many bar owners despondent and why even she is questioning her next move. While T. Cole Newton of the Domino and 12 Mile Limit shares how he managed to turn a small profit during the brief time he was allowed to sell to go. We're calling on City Hall in a desperate move to save New Orleans bar culture on this week's Louisiana Eats. Nestled within a few square blocks between Magazine Street and the Mississippi River docks, New Orleans' Irish Channel neighborhood is home to a diverse, close-knit community with working-class roots. The area's history is reflected in its vibrant shotgun houses and small businesses, including an unassuming corner bar that's been an Irish Channel institution since 1931. Pete's out in the cold.
We used to have 10 bars like this in this neighborhood. Every two blocks we had one.
Right.
We had a dinosaur.
Yeah.
Retired New Orleans firefighter Kevin Lee has been the self-described facilitator of Pete's Out in the Cold since 1994. Every day since the COVID-19 shutdown, he's been sitting alone inside of Pete's. Walking by, neighbors wave at Kevin's camera to say hi or honk the horn when they pass. Nearby resident and Louisiana Eats producer Reggie Morris recently joined Kevin at the shuttered neighborhood bar to learn more.
Kevin, you're still coming to the bar even though the bar is closed.
Twice a day.
Why are you coming to the bar?
One, for my sanity, because this place is, special to me. It's special to a lot of people, and if people see my vehicle, they know we're closed, but we're not gone, and it just gives them a little comfort about things can get back to the way they used to be. Whenever they see me, they ask me when you're going to open up. They want to come have a drink. Just to, why can't you open? Everybody else is opening, man. You don't do nothing wrong,
right.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's heartwarming, but it's also sad. Basically, I've been coming in here since I was mid-teens. And it's just some place that makes me feel good and makes everyone else feel good. And that's what a neighborhood bar is, comfort.
We just found out that we're not moving to phase three as the rest of Louisiana is. What do you think is going to happen in the future? You think you're going to be able to get back open in a month or so? Or?
I thought we were going to be opened by now.
Yeah.
I thought, if nothing else, we would be able to go back to, to-go drinks, people sitting at tables and us serving them. I thought that economically the city needs us as much as we need to be open. They need us to be open.
Mm-hmm.
See, look, somebody thinks I'm open now. They come up to the door. Because they saw my car. Yeah.
How does the Irish Channel feel about you still being here, in spite of not being able to get a drink?
They're angrier than I am. So you just smile and you let them know that, hey, don't give up. I don't go down without a fight, you know? And I'm talking about is maneuvering in a manipulated system, which I do believe we're dealing with right now.
Yeah.
It's one thing if there's a hurricane coming and you got to shut down for business, or the streets are really bad and dangerous. You can get through that because you have some type of control of moving through it. This, you're sitting in a corner waiting for them to tell you it's time to go. You can open back up. And the worst thing they did to us was let us open back up and then shut us back down. Because now people think we're still open. A lot of people don't know little neighborhood bars that they're closing up slowly but surely. I just don't like the fact of myself and others possibly losing their lives to politics. You know, and that's basically what it is that, oh, it's not my fault. It's not my fault. Well, let me open.
Yeah.
You know, we're grown-ups. Let us be adults.
Yeah.
Just give me a voice. Because nobody wants to listen to us.
Yeah.
And most of the people don't even know we're screaming.
That was Kevin Lee of Irish Channel Institution, Pete's Out in the Cold, speaking with our producer, Reggie Morris. On the edge of the Treme neighborhood runs Bayou Road, one of the oldest streets in the country. Today, this historic business corridor is home to a number of locally based black-owned businesses. One of the newest is Whiskey and Sticks, helmed by Kelder Summers Jones and Ken Jones. Kelder joined us via Zoom to share the story of their neighborhood bar and the hoops they've had to jump through to comply with rapidly changing regulations.
My husband was in television for 30 or so years. I have been in radio for about that long, about 30 years as well. The Whiskey and Sticks idea was that we would retire as old barkeeps and, you know, still be able to play upon our community connections and play upon the fact that we sort of, you know, talked for a living. And that's kind of what you want to get when you go to a bar, right? You want to have a great conversation and you want to have a sense of familiarity. And our official opening date was August 15th of 2018. So we've been open just past just over 2 years.
And how was it going? How was everything going until the start of this year?
We were doing great. You know, in 2018, we were voted NOLA.com's top five new bars in New Orleans. And we were seeing a lot of great traffic. We were doing a lot of great events, social events, parties and trivia nights and tastings. You know, we had a great little niche there of bourbon drinkers here in the city. And they knew they could come and have a great conversation and just, you know, have a wonderful time. We were pacing to do better in 2020 for the first quarter, pacing better than we had done in the previous year in 2019.
And then along comes the pandemic. Tell me how this has been for the two of you.
So we closed down on, I want to say the 13th was the last day that we were open, 13th of March. And then, as luck would have it, both my husband and myself actually got COVID. We both had it. And so my husband's case was not as severe. Over the course of about 3 weeks, he was recovered. My case, however, was a lot more serious, and I ended up in the hospital. So for the latter part of March, the entire part of April, and for the most part of May, I was dealing with COVID, and my husband was dealing with my health. Our bartenders, you know, they were furloughed, they weren't working, and the bar was just closed, no business whatsoever. We weren't even thinking about it. Honestly, we were just concerned with me getting back to normal. When I was back to normal, the first thought was, okay, now we got to pick this thing back up and see what we can do and how we can do it within the parameters that were set by the city. And as people who had gotten the virus, who had survived the virus, we were just adamant about, you know, running through those, that checklist and making sure we follow the rules and the guidelines to the teeth. And so we opened. Then literally a couple of weeks later, we were told, okay, now, you know, you can't do to-go drinks and you can't have, you can sell frozen drinks and all this.
Kelder, talk to me about that frozen drink thing, because I have to tell you, I'm so confused that there was a time when the city suggested, oh, you can sell to go, but it's got to be frozen, right?
Yeah, exactly. Let's just do some little background. Our bar is not, we are not a bar slash restaurant. We don't sell food. So because we don't sell food, you know, we were very limited in how we could open. So I think their idea was that the frozen drinks, you know, they're prepackaged, you serve them in a, you know, a cup with a lid, and you know, it just eliminated a lot of exposure to bartenders handling ingredients and that sort of thing. So I think that was the thought process behind that. I don't know, but that's what I think.
So the city told you, in essence, you want to operate your business? Maybe a frozen drink machine is a good idea.
Either try to sell some food, you know, and we noticed folks were, you know, in the French Quarter, we noticed folks that were getting around this by doing stuff like offering beef jerky, you know, or popcorn or something like that. And so we just didn't want to do that. So they say, yeah, why not do frozen drinks? And we're like, okay, you know what? Let's do that. After it's all over, we can possibly, you know, make some money with a frozen drink machine. So we went ahead and got us a frozen drink machine. And before it even had the chance to be taken out of the box, I don't even think we had gotten it delivered. before it was even delivered, then the mandate came, okay, no to-go drinks, no frozen drinks, bars are effectively closed.
And this was not a small investment. I mean, that was a chunk of change.
For a small business, it was a huge chunk of change. And you top that off with all of the other things that you were doing, you know, to make sure your place was safe. The fact that we had recently paid our licenses renewals and that we had to get inventory. I mean, it was a nice little investment we had to make to even get to the point where we could sell to-go drinks and frozen drinks. And then before we could even put the first little, you know, frozen French 75 in a cup, we were closed.
How have you all been coping with the bills and such? At least the landlord's friendly, right?
Yeah. Our landlord's been very helpful. And but, you know, now it's time for us, you know, they're saying, you know, we got to start paying something. And so they're, you know, giving some folks some leeway, but, you know, they're asking for us to start trying to do some, you know, make some payments. And so we haven't been, you know, getting any income in to start this business. We did not get into any debt, which probably in hindsight, we probably should have and, you know, done that. But we utilize my husband's, you know, 401k as retirement to pay for everything. And so that's basically all gone. He has no hope of recouping that if we have to shutter our doors permanently. And so right now we were able to get a small business loan that allowed us to stay open during the time that, you know, we were allowed to be open. And we've applied for the state funding that's out there now. But we are now down to our pretty much our last when it comes to trying to sustain this business. And it's been very, very stressful.
How are you sleeping at night, girl?
Not sleeping. The anxiety, as I said, is just unbelievable. It can be crippling sometimes.
What is in your mind for what the solution could possibly be?
I mean, we think about this all the time. First, I believe that, you know, there should be some sort of parity across the board. I mean, I think if you're going to close all bars and close all the bars, do not allow any bars to operate if that's what you're going to do. But honestly, I don't think that bars are the problem. If you look at this weekend, you had bars closed, but you had huge, huge crowds of people out there anyway, and bars were closed. So to me, if you've ever taken a logic class, that says to me, if there were huge crowds and bars were closed, then bars are not the problem. And so I believe that you should allow bars to open. Those people that are going to open responsibly, let them do that. When you come across those bars that are, you know, the quote unquote bad actors doing the wrong things, close them down, take their licenses. But those things that are now affecting businesses that are really just trying to do the right thing, I just feel like those mandates should be lifted and folks should be allowed to now make their own decisions about whether or not they are feeling, you know, they're going to go out, they're going to patronize a bar, a restaurant or whatever. And I think those decisions now need to be put into the hands of the consumers and the citizens and those business owners who, you know, really, really want to do the right thing and really need right now to be open.
Have you been able to have any conversation with anybody at City Hall or anybody that might have a say in this? Is anybody listening?
You know, there's some Polly with Avenue Pub has been really great. She's been an advocate for the small bars here in the city. And she actually connected me with some folks that were, you know, creating a focus group and what have you. But honestly, it's just so frustrating. You know, my first question when we were, you know, talking about reopening, my first question was, could we revert as our little bar, revert to a package store? We were thinking that maybe we could get some relief there and we would be allowed to, you know, do package. But no, nobody is considering that. And it's just sort of a you're just out on your own now. I don't have the energy right now, Poppy, to go and try and fight for this, you know, because at every step, it just seems that
we are on the bad end of things and not being considered at all. So I don't have the energy.
That was Kelder Summers Jones of Whiskey and Sticks on Bayou Road in New Orleans. Coming up next, we speak with Polly Watts, owner of the Avenue Pub, an advocate for the bar community during the coronavirus shutdown. Louisiana Eats returns after the break.
Kaylee, Paul Mouncey, Eileen Ivers, and Baka Beyond combine the instruments and voices of Celtic music with the rhythms and arrangements of a global sound. Along with them, we're taking Celtic music out into the world this week on the Thistle and Shamrock. Why don't you come with us?
Coming up Sunday at 6 p.m. on KRVS.
All that data collection.
They have the last 10 years of your movements.
It can have real-life consequences.
If you have that much information on people, that information is going to be misused.
I'm Anoush Zamarodi, and who decides what's right or wrong in our digital world?
This is a great question. This is the big one.
Writing the rules for life online. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Coming up tonight at 7 on KRVS.
This is listener-supported public radio for Acadiana, KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles. Like us on Facebook at KRVS Public Media.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Camellia Brand, Beans Done Right, a New Orleans tradition since 1923, and from the Napoleon House in New Orleans French Quarter, now offering dine-in as well as takeout Tuesday through Saturday, including toasty warm muffuladas, gumbo, frozen Pimm's cups, and more. They may be reached online at napoleonhouse.com and at 504-524-9752. And now, back to Louisiana Eats. Longtime listeners will recognize our next guest, Polly Watts, owner of the Avenue Pub, an advocate for the bar community during the coronavirus shutdown. Since taking over the Avenue Pub from her father in 2006, she has reshaped her father's dive bar into one of the Southeast's best destinations for craft beer. While what's on tap may have changed, the neighborhood vibe has remained.
At one point, after I took over from my dad, I was tempted to put up a marriage and baby wall, you know, the way you see in the gynecologist's office, the obstetrician's office, where he's got all the pictures of the babies. Well, we have tons of marriages from people that met at the pub, or they had their first or second date at the pub, or the pub was their place when they were dating. And now they're married and they have kids. And I've stayed in touch with a lot of them, even though they may have moved to other communities. New Orleans is a city of neighborhoods. And everybody has a neighborhood bar, and we do a lot of our meeting and greeting and mourning and have joyfulness in bars. It's where we go for our first date. It's where we meet our spouses for the first time. It's where we go after a hurricane, and we just want to rejoice that we're still alive, or we go when we want to mourn and see what kind of help we can get, emotional help we can get from each other. We were open after Katrina before the power was cut on, and everybody who filtered back into the neighborhood filtered through us. And we make friends that way. it's tied to the fabric of the city, not only at the pub, but, you know, there are places like the pub in every neighborhood in the city of New Orleans.
Tell me about how it has been as a small business owner to try to learn the dance steps and then do that dance. This has been a very tricky, tricky road.
It's been a challenge. And I'm going to say some things that are going to sound, you know, sort of like I'm crying for my own business. In some ways I am, but I'm also crying for businesses that don't have the opportunities that we do. You know, we are so lucky that we own our own building and I don't have to pay rent and I don't have a mortgage, which gives my business staying power that is fairly unusual in my industry. But the on and off shutdown that we've experienced since the end of March through today has been devastating. The days of, you know, the city coming and saying, oh, you can do this, and 4 days later the state comes out and says, well, no, and then the city cracks down even more 4 days after that. Even when we were open for a brief time during the second phase, we at most did 15 to 20% of our normal slow summer sales, which is, had it not been for the PPP at the time, would not have been enough to pay the bills, even the basic bills, without a mortgage. You know, every time you open up, you're buying products, you're bringing staff in, and then to find out a week or 2 weeks later that you can't sell any of that, you lose all that product. And it also messes with your staff, because the staff thinks, okay, now I've got a job, I can go ahead and I stop filing for unemployment, I can stop looking. They come back and 2 weeks later they don't have a job again. Now, that was less of an issue early on because people had some reserves, and the federal unemployment was large enough that it really helped some people put some reserves in place. Not everybody was able to, but most of my staff was. And what we're experiencing now is that those reserves are dwindling. So that's going to become even more critical on a human level over the next couple of months than it was over the summer, I believe.
You have the advantage of being able to sit in on these calls with city business leaders and a liaison from the mayor's office. For the small bar owner, how can they even begin to guesstimate when they can reopen again?
Well, it's a challenge, but we had been asking the city and the health department to provide us with something a little bit more definitive, or a lot more definitive, about the metrics they were going to use in order to reopen bars. And what they told us in August, early August, finally they gave us the metrics, and they said, we will not loosen current restrictions prior to the children, kids being successfully back in school for 4 to 6 weeks. Didn't give actual dates. And, you know, I'm running the numbers in my head and realizing, well, she's talking mid-October to late October. Is that correct? And she confirmed, yes, it is. They haven't actually said those dates. And I assume they didn't say it because the kids back in school date was a moving target. And I think that they didn't want people to become glued to October 15th. I understand their reasoning, but part of the challenge as a business owner, again, is the planning. And I think there are an awful lot of business owners that are waiting on tenterhooks for the announcement that they can reopen when it doesn't appear that that reopening is going to happen immediately at all. You know, I don't want to be the person that is crying to let the gates open and let the virus crash over us in a wave that is uncontrollable. I do honestly believe that the mayor and the governor too, and the mayor's staff are, and the health department are doing what they feel is important to preserve life in this city. And it's one of the reasons that I've backed the mayor and her approach, you know, almost from the beginning, because while it hurt me personally, financially, I think in the long run, if our goal is to become a tourist city again, tourists have to feel comfortable coming here because we are safe. Employees have to feel safe working where they're going to work. So I don't want to bash the powers that be for not letting bars open. What I want to see is some more creative thought and implementation that would allow for a tether to life for these establishments that may go under without help.
Well, that was one of the reasons I really wanted to talk with you today, in hopes that other people like me might think really hard about New Orleans without neighborhood bars.
Well, I think that's exactly what concerns me. I mean, I'm sure there are lots of communities outside of New Orleans that see bars as this sort of evil, you know, excuse the expression, big ass beers on Bourbon Street kind of thing. But most of the bars in New Orleans are not like that. They're almost community centers to the areas that they serve. I don't even know if we realize as a community how much a part of our daily fabric they are in the neighborhoods all over the city. Just to give you an example, I spoke briefly with one of my distributors this morning, and she gave me some numbers that are truly frightening. In Orleans Parish, there were 256 accounts with bar licenses, bar tavern licenses, purchased goods in August of 2019. In August of 2020, he had 49 accounts purchased goods.
Oh, my gosh.
It's a 92% reduction in volume. Obviously not a 92% reduction in, if you do the math, in accounts. But those 49, even of those 49, some of them were probably like me. I ordered, you know, three cases of water right before the hurricane, even though I'm not technically open, but it technically made me a customer. Mm. You know, I would be in that 49, even though I'm not open. There are probably a few like that as well. So that's over 200 businesses that we know about that simply are just, they're closed. I mean, I'm hearing about businesses every day that are closing that haven't made the news. I've heard Mimi's in the Marigny is basically not able to continue to operate. I don't know if somebody else has taken over. I mean, I think we're going to hear these things more and more often, and they won't necessarily make the news because they're neighborhood places. Mimi's has a broader audience because of music, but you know, the places that are important to that little community, the community will just be without it. It won't necessarily make the list that goes into NOLA.com. And, you know, it's not necessarily a place that a tourist cares about, but it's a piece of who we are as a city.
If you could offer solutions, do you have any? And is there anything that you would suggest the listeners do?
You know, in my perfect world, the city would be able to allow bars to operate and do the enforcement for the bad players. I feel like the bad players have caused an enormous amount of pain to the little places that are just trying to survive. So that would be my first request, is for us to actually see enforcement on a level that would allow people who are playing by the rules and who have the intent to keep their customer base and their employees safe to continue to operate. That would be the first thing. I guess the second thing I would ask of the public is to be very conscious of how you go to restaurants and how you participate in bars should we reopen, because that behavior and the perception of that behavior once we do reopen, if we are able to, could prevent another shutdown. And I guess my biggest thing is wear a mask, wear a mask, wear a mask.
Polly, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us, and I look forward to seeing you again in happier times.
Me too. Thank you, Poppy.
That was Polly Watts, owner of the Avenue Pub. Thank you. What's the history of the New Orleans Go Cup? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back.
Are you interested in K-pop music, but can never find it on your local radio? Well, look no further. With K-pop Fever, we have boy groups, girl groups, soloists, and all of your K-pop favorites. So join me, JC, on Mondays at midnight with KRVS on 88.7 FM radio.
Cajun, swamp pop, zydeco, creole, and more. It's all right here on Encore with me, your host, Megan Constantin. Saturday mornings at 7 and Sunday afternoons at 3.
Later today on This American Life, Rachel is a victim of identity theft. And she did all the stuff that you're supposed to do when that happens. She canceled her credit cards, closed her accounts, but it just kept happening. For years, until the day she realized how it kept happening.
I got to the point where I thought someone was following me. Like, I was just so paranoid that I would, like, try to find alternate routes to get to my P.O. box.
That's later today.
Coming up tonight at 7 on KRVS.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with support from Louisiana Fish Fry, breadings, boils, new air fry mixes, and more classic Louisiana dishes available everywhere. Dig into homemade Louisiana flavor. And from the St. Tammany Parish Tourist Commission, Louisiana's North Shore is turning up the heat for the annual Tammany Taste of Summer. Plan your escape to St. Tammany Parish for delicious adventures from August 1st through September 30th. Learn how to get your own Tammany Taste of Summer pass by visiting TammanyTaste.com. Louisiana's North Shore, where New Orleans has come to play and get away for more than a century. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen. What's the history of the New Orleans Go Cup? For most of American history, it was legal to drink on the street, just not to be drunk in public. By the 1980s and 90s, most cities had outlawed public drinking, but not New Orleans. The increasingly seedy strip clubs and bars along Bourbon Street had introduced to-go windows in the 1960s, where pedestrians could grab a beverage in a paper or plastic cup. The practice exploded when New Orleanian Corrado Giacona invented the Mardi Gras Go Cup, which was first thrown on a cold February day by the crew of Ala, and also adopted that same year by the Metairie crew of Rhea. Over 300,000 cups were thrown that first carnival, but by 1982, more than 25 crews were tossing Giacona's invention. Now, because of COVID-19, that icon of New Orleans merriment is under attack, and New Orleans is the only parish in the state not allowed to sell drinks to go. Perhaps our city's leaders need to take a historical trip back in time and revisit a concept first introduced during the bubonic plague of the Middle Ages: wine windows. After Florence was ravaged by the plague in 1634, small windows began to appear in the city, where with a knock, one could receive a flask of wine along with a metal plate for payment. The wine sellers would then disinfect the coins with vinegar, making the exchange plague-free. Over 150 windows have been cataloged in modern-day Florence, where now, due to COVID-19, their popularity is experiencing a resurgence. In 2019, Webster's Dictionary officially added the Go Cup to their lexicon. Please, Madam Mayor, allow New Orleans her to-go drinks so that all of our treasured neighborhood bars can have a fighting chance. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. With its reasonably priced drinks, dance floor, and pool table, the cocktail bar 12 Mile Limit is a jewel in New Orleans' bar scene. Tucked in a quiet corner of the largely residential mid-city neighborhood, the bar is the kind of place locals will often walk or bike to for a refreshing cocktail and conversation. T. Cole Newton, who goes by Cole, is owner of 12 Mile Limit, and his recently opened wine bar, The Domino. Cole has emerged as a vocal advocate for the local bar scene in the wake of the pandemic. But, as he explained to us, the shutdown is only the most recent existential threat to these community institutions.
Neighborhood bars are a real hub of a community. And over the last couple of decades, we've seen nationwide, not just in New Orleans. New Orleans is, I think, doing better than most places, or at least was until the most recent unpleasantness of preserving the neighborhood bar as an important cultural institution in the city. But places like Chicago, places like Milwaukee, cities all across the country with a renowned neighborhood bar and drinking culture, the paradigm is shifting away from a neighborhood bar and moving towards nightlife districts, places that accumulate all of the so-called negative externalities that people associate with bars and move them into discrete, controllable areas away from neighborhoods, away from residential centers. So the only reason the neighborhood bars are allowed to exist currently is because they have been existing. It's a non-conforming use. And so zoning right now, if you want to open a neighborhood bar that is in a residential neighborhood, it is virtually impossible to do that. It's much more likely that a neighborhood bar closes. And when a neighborhood bar is closed for more than 3 months, I think the restrictions will be a little different this time because they're not closed of their own volition. But say it takes another 3 months after bars are allowed to reopen for a bar to get the funding together to even reopen, because that's not cheap, then they might lose their non-conditional use permanently. And a lot of these neighborhood bars that have continued to exist only because they've continued to exist will cease to be. So a lot of the bars that I'm thinking of are 12 Mile Limit's one of them. Pals on the other side of Mid-City. It's a real institution, does a lot of good in this community. Pete's out in the cold in the Irish Channel. I used to love that bar when I was in that neighborhood. I mean, and to be fair, I worry less about a lot of these bars because they're white bars. But the restrictions, when they rewrote the entire ABO ordinance in the city a couple of years ago, and I was fortunate to have the opportunity to weigh in on the new code that they wrote. But one of the things that they were explicitly working to do was create ways for neighborhoods to get rid of nuisance businesses, which are almost always like corner stores, liquor stores, and neighborhood bars that were non-conforming uses in residential areas. And those tools should exist. I'm not saying that you can't shut down a bar in your neighborhood if they are bad actors, but the idea that these bars are inherently problematic is something that we have to fight back against, I think, really, because I think, like I said, they are hubs of the community. And the way that nightlife is being segregated into certain specific districts, it concentrates the economic activity in the hands of the wealthy elite. It's an undemocratic process, and it creates those negative externalities. Those problems that people associate with nightlife will only be greater if that nightlife is concentrated away from a residential area that forces it to be responsive and behave appropriately.
It's just a terrible situation, and these are terrible times. You touched on the racial element that concerns you. What are your concerns about the minority-owned bars?
I worry that, I mean, historically, it was enshrined in the Constitution from the very founding of this country that white men who own property were allowed to vote, right? And that everyone else was not. And we've slowly expanded the franchise to include people who don't own property and people to women and people of color. But it is embedded in the fiber of our country that the voices of white men who own land means more than any other community. And that is still the case. And so when there's a bar that's been in a neighborhood that's historically been a black neighborhood, or at least for the last 50, 60 years has been a black neighborhood, and that's a black owned bar in a residential neighborhood, and the neighborhood, like many neighborhoods in New Orleans, is becoming less and less black over time and more white, specifically over time, those new white neighbors are much more likely to view a black owned bar in that neighborhood as inherently problematic as a nuisance business, regardless of whether or not they are operating responsibly. I would refer you, I'm not an expert on that exactly. I would refer you to MACNO, the Music and Culture Coalition of New Orleans. They've done a lot of work in preserving black owned bars in residential neighborhoods, but it's a fight. And I would say that there are a lot of people who don't want any bars in their neighborhoods, and they come for the low-hanging fruit. They come for the gay bars, they come for the black bars. If we stay silent, if the white bar owners stay silent as they come for the institutions that serve these other communities, then once those institutions are gone, they're gonna come for us next. It's gonna happen. So if it's in our own economic interest to speak up for all of these bars that are in danger right now.
Tell us a little bit about how this pandemic thing has rolled for you.
It's been an adventure, to say the least. The week leading up to the initial shutdown in March, things escalated so quickly, it was really hard to just even keep up with everything. We were ready to stay open up through even Friday of the weekend before closing. And then by that Sunday, even before the city and state announced that they were shutting everything down, we'd completely flipped and decided for both bars that the responsible thing to do was to close up shop entirely for the time being. We were shut down completely for about a month and a half. After that point, I was able to get, for 12 Mile, a conditional restaurant permit. And really all that meant is that, because we were still doing food sales were always allowed, but we could also do alcohol sales as long as our alcohol sales did not exceed our food sales. Whatever the city was allowing us to do, we were one step behind that. So when the city said, you can open at 25% capacity, we opened up our patio. When the city said, you can open at 50% capacity, we opened at 25% capacity. And so during what I was referring to at the time as phase zero, we were only allowed to do takeout drinks. We just did takeout drinks. And we pushed a little bit there to open as much as we could during that phase. But once we were actually allowed to open for on-premise business, we were very careful and always tried to stay one step behind where the city was. And the city was always one step behind where the state was. So we were being as abundantly safe and cautious as we could. And then the yo-yo swung back, the pendulum swung back in the other direction. And currently, we are not allowed to do any kind of beverage sales whatsoever. So it swung back pretty hard, pretty fast. We were only allowed to do takeout and to-go drinks, frozen specialties and packaged drinks. That was allowed again for a while. And then after about 2 weeks of that, they shut that down too. That's been pretty hard because I was really geared up to really lean into the frozen specialties and packaged drink sales. We have a pretty robust frozen drink program at the Domino. The packaged specialty cocktails leans really well into what we do at 12 Mile Limit. And we were actually able to eke out a small profit in the middle of the summer with those restrictions in place, which really felt, I think, both safe and responsible, both to the staff at both bars and to our customers. Our customers weren't eager to return for on-premise business, and I wasn't eager to offer it. I only kind of did it because it felt obligatory. It felt like we'd be left behind if we didn't offer it when it was allowed. But in hindsight, I would prefer to just be allowed to do takeout drink sales for the indefinite future. That feels like the only safe and responsible way to operate right now as a bar owner.
So takeout was working for you because June was not the worst month of the year for you, was it?
No, honestly, we lost more money when we were fully open in January and February. And that's just the seasonal rhythms. I'm not saying we were in dire straits, but you know, some months you profit, some months you don't. But we lost a little bit of money when we were fully open earlier this year. And we turned a profit in June when we were only allowed to do, I think part of June we were allowed to do on-premise and part of June we were only allowed to do takeout drinks. But the patchwork business that we were allowed to put together, we actually did turn a profit in June. And part of that's that, like, our overhead is much lower. When we were doing the batch cocktails to go, I had people order in advance. So we knew exactly how much we had to order. We knew exactly how much we had to prepare. I could run it myself and do it with almost no overhead, very little waste. Our utility bills are lower. So being able to operate for takeout business because our operating expenses have pared down to the bare, bare minimum, we were able to do it profitably. We can tread water pretty much indefinitely if we're allowed to do packaged drinks to go.
Cole, what's New Orleans going to be without neighborhood bars?
Cleveland.
Ouch.
I don't know. I honestly don't know what the bar scene in Cleveland is like.
Forgive us to anybody listening in Cleveland, but...
Yeah, it's the long run. Isn't it Mark Twain, maybe?
Every place else.
Cleveland. Yeah,
no, isn't that Tennessee Williams?
Cleveland is a fine city. I think it's commonly misattributed to Mark Twain. I think that's by me included. But that's honestly, again, that's what a lot of people want. And I don't think that's the goal. I have friends at City Hall. I know they're well-meaning. I know they're not coming for neighborhood bars by design. I just worry that that's going to be the effect, that they're looking out for public health, and that is their mandate. And I fully agree that we shouldn't be allowed to just open bars willy-nilly. You know, I just want to serve a to-go drink out the front door. I think that is a safe and responsible way to operate. And it's safer than opening a restaurant that allows people inside, in my opinion. I'm not a public health expert, caveat.
Cole, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and your wit with us today on Louisiana Eats. I can't wait till the next time I can see you, maybe with a cocktail in person.
Oh, and maybe we could even have a hug. How crazy is that?
That was T. Cole Newton, owner of cocktail bar 12 Mile Limit and wine bar The Domino. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats. Edible content for Louisiana food lovers. The Southern Food and Beverage Museum has reopened and is ready to welcome visitors into their newly redesigned galleries. Museum hours are 11:30 to 5:30 p.m. Thursday through Monday. To plan your visit, call ahead for a reservation or book online. We hope to see you here soon. Catch up on previous editions of Louisiana Eats on poppytooker.com, where we have 10 years of Louisiana Eats editions available for pod and webcasting, along with recipes and videos, too. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Louisiana Fish Fry, Camellia Brand Beans, and the St. Tammany Parish Tourist Commission. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the baby of the Dickie Brennan and Company family of restaurants. Acorn is now open in City Park. Located at the Louisiana Children's Museum, Acorn is open Wednesday through Sunday from 10 a.m. till 6 p.m. Coffee, breakfast, lunch, and snacks served up with some of the best views in the city. Original theme music composed by David Pomerleau and performed by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to senior producer Joe Schreiner and producer and special projects manager Reggie Morris, and to our business manager and social media maven, Maddie Mulladew. Catch up with us anytime on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, too. Louisiana Eats is a production of Poppy Tooker Broadcasting.